I'll repeat something about the charge for my invitation. It's not to give a philosophy lecture in the usual sense, not to offer new arguments with the aim of advancing some part of the field. Rather, I am told it is meant to be a sort of intellectual autobiography with perhaps some account of how I was shaped by the world of philosophy I encountered or helped to shape it. This along with, as the charge reads, how the profession seems to have changed over the years. The charge goes on, the lecturer might reflect on the people and issues that brought him or her into philosophy and to provide a personal perspective on the state of the field today. The autobiographical aspect of this seems the easier part. Trying to draw lessons from it, I find daunting. The charge specifies that the lecture needn't be about John Dewey, and for me that's a good thing. Despite Dewey's preceding me teaching philosophy at Michigan, I am terribly ignorant about him. When I've started to read him, I haven't been drawn to continue. My ignorant hypothesis is that that's because Dewey's thinking has become so much of the thinking of the rest of us that his thoughts don't seem as novel as they must have when he was writing. So I'll proceed to be autobiographical and reflective without regard to Dewey. I imagine I was drawn to philosophy somewhat as the rest of us were. For me, part of it was fascination with physics at the age of 10 with the construction of atoms and molecules. An even more significant part, though, was religion. I attended my Presbyterian Sunday school faithfully and thought I knew all the answers. Does science contradict the Bible? No, the Bible doesn't say how long a day was. But one time I was stumped. My Sunday school teacher asked us solemnly, "What is God?" And I realized in a panic that I didn't have an answer to that question. She then turned to the Epistle of St. Paul, where he says, "God is love." The scales fell from my eyes, and I realized that you didn't have to believe in supernatural stuff to qualify as a good person, to be a good Christian. Over the next few years, though, I came to realize that love isn't what most people meant by the term God, and so in a way that would have horrified me if I had come to it more directly, I came to realize that I was an atheist. Morality I still took seriously, but morality didn't need a God. It was years later that I encountered the Euthyphro argument, but I was prepared for it, and prepared to ask myself what grounds morality, if not the disapprovals of a supernatural being. When I got to Swarthmore, when I got to college, my parents told me that they thought I might be interested in philosophy. I was skeptical. Philosophy, I was convinced, consists in offering specious arguments for the existence of God. Still, I would give it a try. I had the wonderful good fortune of being taught by Jerome Schaefer in sections of 50 students, most of whom sat in the back and smoked while a few of us sat in front and engaged Mr. Schaefer while he teased us with his questions. Each faculty member at Swarthmore taught two introductory courses each term plus one more advanced class or seminar. How easy, in contrast, were our assignments later when I myself was teaching. Apart from ethics, I was entranced by phenomenalism. With my teachers, Schaefer and Richard Brandt especially, I got the impression that wonderful teaching of philosophy comes natural to anyone with an avid concern with philosophical questions. My entire teaching life after was filled with disappointments when success in engaging students didn't always seem to flow naturally from my own philosophical concerns or proclivities. I should say perhaps not everybody was as engaged by Brandt and Schaefer as I was, but I took it that everyone was enthralled. Jagwon Kim taught me symbolic logic. He had been delayed by growing up in the midst of the Korean War, and this was his first year of teaching. He told me later that symbolic logic had been new to him, and he was feverishly preparing each night, but I never would have guessed. I admired him immensely and still do, but it wasn't he who really hooked me on philosophy. My senior year, in the midst of Brandt's moral philosophy seminar, I decided that instead of continuing in math or physics right away, I would first join the Peace Corps. I had given much thought to Albert Schweitzer, who decided that he would pursue his own passions until age 30 and then devote himself to humanity. He became a medical doctor serving in Gabon in Central Africa. I told the Peace Corps I wanted to go to the Far East or South Asia, which I thought fascinating parts of the world, and they invited me to Gabon. I was disappointed. John Gunther, in his book Inside Africa, quoted a Frenchman saying, "It's purgatory." Still, I reluctantly agreed to go there to do my service. Then the Peace Corps told me that the Gabon government had changed its request and they wanted me to go to Ghana. Ghana was a country I had heard of as the first African colony to gain independence. And when I asked around, everybody who knew Ghana was enthusiastic. I learned from talking with my fellows that they hadn't taken duties of service to humanity as a strong reason to join up. I'm afraid since then, I have not managed to be so devoted to humanitarian duty. My motivations have included duties to do and teach philosophy well, which has fascinated me. At that point, I had never been outside North America, and so I was eager to get to know a really novel culture. I was assigned to Achimota School, a top school in the country. It was a very un-Peace Corps-like assignment. My dad showed him his friends pictures of the school's magnificent chapel and assembly hall and said, "Isn't it wonderful how these young people go to the ends of the earth to help humanity?" Just as I arrived in Ghana, the great W.B. Du Bois died. He had settled in Ghana out of despair with America's racial situation. His memorial service was held at the chapel of my school, led by Kwame Nkrumah, Ghana's first president. However, so eager was I to see some of the rest of the country that I went off to Ghana's second city, Kumasi, for the weekend. I had a wonderful, informative time there and was ever after conflicted about whether I had made the right choice. Decades later, I got to know my stepmother-in-law, Noma Jensen Janae, who had worked with Thurgood Marshall and had known Dr. Du Bois, as she always called him, had known him well. Speakers at Achimota School during that period included Malcolm X and Cassius Clay. Not terribly long before I left Ghana to go to graduate school in philosophy at Harvard, a friend of my father's dropped by returning to America from East Africa, where West Virginia University conducted a foreign aid program. He asked me what I planned to do, and I told him, "Don't go into philosophy," he told me, "do economics. That way you can have a choice of many careers, academic or otherwise." I found this a convincing argument, but part of me felt I had wasted 2 years away from serious engagement with philosophy and advancing into a career in the field. Switching to economics would have taken a further year and also exposed me to the military draft. I'm now quite happy with having stayed on in philosophy, But the advice to do economics had some effect on me. The Harvard graduate program required the choice of a couple of cognate courses. I had taken almost no undergraduate economics, but I enrolled in the introductory graduate economic theory course, which grew nicely on my mathematics background, and had the great good fortune to be taught by the eminent economic theorist Vasily Leontief. Further good fortune ensued, giving me another subject of research somewhat isolated from my others, social choice theory in the vein of Kenneth Arrow. How this developed, I find quite amazing. And in the early years of my career, I was much better known among economists than among philosophers. At Harvard, in the little Robbins Graduate Philosophy Library, I stumbled across Arrow's little blue book, Social Choice and Individual Values. I pulled it off the shelf and was intrigued by what I found. This was the first edition, I believe, with a mistake I could spot that he corrected in the second edition. I thought I had a lot to say against Arrow's conclusions. His condition, independence of irrelevant alternatives, seemed to me not to be required. Patrick Henry's give me liberty or give me death seemed to be to indicate a very strong preference for life with liberty over life without liberty, a preference that should bear special weight, even if for that pair, death was an irrelevant alternative. I then learned that Arrow was coming to Harvard, and that moreover, he and my teacher, John Rawls, were giving a joint seminar together, indeed together with a young economist from India I had never heard of, Amartya Sen. I told Rawls I wanted to take the seminar, and he said, no, that's only for economics graduate students. I insisted though, and indeed among the six students registered for the seminar, I think only three were economics graduate students. I knew none of the registered students at the time, though later on I came to know some of them. Auditors included Howard Rafa of Luce and Rafa, Grahams and Decisions, Franklin Fisher, the editor of Econometrica, and a young man, Richard Zuckhauser, who was rumored to be national bridge champion. I sat at the seminar, gaping at the conversation and thinking, never before have I witnessed so much intelligence gathered in one room. I spoke up only on a couple of occasions during the whole semester of regular sessions. Finally, it came time for us registered students to present our papers, two at each of the three remaining two-hour sessions. The distinguished auditors disappeared, apart from Rafa, to whom I am eternally grateful. When I got to know him later on, I learned that he had been a colleague in Michigan of my father-in-law, the statistician Cecil Craig. Sen had given a talk in the seminar advocating relaxing Arrow's conditions that social preference be transitive, diminishing it to a requirement of quasi-transitivity, transitivity of strict preference, though not perhaps of indifference. Doing this, he showed, rendered the Arrow conditions consistent. Fiddling around with this proposal, I found that the only schemes that satisfied the conditions that Sen was advocating were what I labeled Liberum veto oligarchies. I had read some Polish history growing up and so knew of the liberum veto in the Polish assembly the same. The oligarchy gets its way if it is unanimous, and if it is split in its preferences, the upshot is social indifference. This was obviously no acceptable way to make social decisions. I didn't realize that Sen had published his proposal, and so couldn't find a quote to show the significance of my result for publication. And so it took me a while to try to publish my result. By the time I found an article advocating non-transitivity of social indifference, others had found the same thing I had. My seminar paper wasn't published until a few years ago through the efforts of economist John Waymark. My first college teaching job was in philosophy at the University of Chicago. They assigned me a seminar in social choice theory, and there I lectured to four students, two of whom were philosophy graduate students, not at home in the subject, and two were auditors who very much knew what they were doing. I was still skeptical of ARIS condition independence of your relevant alternatives, but I thought I remembered that in the story joint seminar, Arrow had said that the condition amounted to immunity from strategic manipulation. So I thought I should work that in and what I said in my seminar, perhaps expecting to spend maybe 5 minutes saying how that worked. Somehow, though, I couldn't get the proof to succeed, and it kept eluding me for weeks. One weekend, I was visiting my fiancée Mary in Urbana, and we decided to spend a couple of hours working. In that intense work session, the main lines of how a proof would go came to me. After that first year of teaching, I spent the summer in England, finding it would be as cheap as staying in Chicago, and I worked my proof up for publication. I sent it to a new journal, Theory and Decision, with a note saying it might be trivial, but I hadn't seen how. I got a specious rejection from the editors and decided I'd better send my proof to a place where they knew what they were doing. I sent it to Econometrica, where I later learned that the two referees had been Arrow and Sen, who clearly knew very well what they were doing. Sometime before I could clear the journal's long backlog and be published, I got a call from a beginning economist, Mark Satterthwaite, saying that he had submitted a proof, and the referee had told him that I had the same result. Although for me, it would have been nice to be exclusive, that was the beginning of a long friendship that has continued up until now. Some aspects of philosophy at Chicago I hated. The graduate school was divided into four divisions: physical sciences, biological sciences, social sciences, and the humanities. Introductory philosophy was part of a three-part introductory humanities sequence. We analytic philosophers were criticized for not making it a true humanities course. Perhaps I was oversensitive, but I thought the pressure to be a true humanity was perverse. As I'll keep indicating in this lecture, I'm all in favor of letting philosophy outside its silo, but that's not only because it should make contact with literary studies, artistic history studies, cultural studies, and other things that got classified as humanities. Philosophy, I'm convinced, should engage with the psychosocial sciences, the nature of the physical sciences, and the biological sciences, especially their basis in the interplay of genetic evolution and culture. I'm tempted to say that philosophy is the most basic of the sciences, although Michael Strevens, in his marvelously challenging book, The Knowledge Machine, traces the remarkable success of science, beginning with Newton, to rules it isn't rational to live by and that philosophy doesn't follow. He thus doesn't regard his own book on science as itself entirely scientific. Philosophy, as I conceive it, looks to all areas of human thinking. It can serve well as an administrative division within the university, but that doesn't mean that there is some nature of the fields classified under it all share. Let me add a conviction that falls under the charge to draw lessons in the Dewey lecture. All of the things we most care about regarding the nature of human beings, human societies, and human cultures are aspects of biology with its genetic evolution making possible cultural development. Nothing about us is non-biological, although I agree, of course, that some aspects of us are more fruitfully studied in light of biological consideration than other foci. Theories of genetic evolution may not much help us with such biological phenomena as Shakespeare's plays or Japanese gamelan, but just as beavers building jams is biological, so is human artistic endeavor. As for art itself, the notion of art is culturally parochial, as has been pointed out by other theorists. Art as such is not a human universal, rather a chief biological feature of our species is elegance. Elegance is indeed a cultural universal, whereas art is not. If not all elegant design counts as art. The concept of art is culturally peculiar. Danto is right in this regard. Pursuing art, this aspect of our culture may be of value, but talk of art isn't getting anything interesting about human endeavor as a whole. The pursuit of elegance, in contrast, is an important feature of our species. My ways of thinking about these things and about the audiovisual arts or more widely have been heavily impacted by my wife, Beth Janae, a historian of art and of music, who has helped pioneer the fairly new field of history of dance, very much including dance in movies. She has started me thinking in a way that I hadn't about the history of the arts. She rescued me and my boys after my first wife, Mary, died during their childhood. Mary was a chemist who moved into history of science and then into performance as on the pipe organ. My son, Steve, designs ways for people to connect to the internet. And my son, George, works, among other things, on African languages, tying in with my own interests from the start of my adult life. Well, before this detour, I had been speaking of my work in economics and its ethics, and so I'll return to that. In philosophy, more narrowly taken, I began publishing in ethics and morality, though without a view of what ethical claims mean. Eventually, I came to a view, and this view has been perfected by the philosopher Howard Knive, who had been one of my brilliant philosophy PhDs. One of the brilliant philosophy PhDs I've taught at Michigan. Briefly, my view includes a general claim about the nature of normative concepts and a claim about the nature of concepts that are specifically moral in a narrow sense. My view of normative concepts is a form of what I call expressivism, closely related to the views of R.M. Hare and Simon Blackburn. I'll put it more compactly, then they'll be quickly intelligible. Normative concepts are to be explained by the psychological nature of thinking with them. To come to a normative view, a view as to whether a state of mind such as a belief or a feeling towards something is rational, to use Brandt's favorite term, is to settle whether to be in that state of mind. More particularly, to come to a view of as to whether a degree of belief is rational, strong belief that the earth goes around the sun, for instance, is to settle whether to have such a degree of belief. Many philosophers will disagree with this. They think that I could come to a view that the state of mind is rational, but settle on rejecting it. I don't think that any such view of rationality is intelligible. Deciding what degree of belief is rational to have can't be something clear that is distinct from deciding whether to have that degree of belief. As for moral concepts in a narrow sense of the term moral, They have to do with feelings of obligation to do things. To say that a murder I'm contemplating would be morally wrong is to settle on feeling obligated not to convey it if the question arises. Strongly enough obligated to keep me from committing the murder. Narrowly moral concepts are less normative concepts of a special kind tied to feelings of obligation. Nye has further things to say on this, but I'm giving the gist of his account. One of my central foci in philosophy has been on what I just said, the nature of normative concepts and of moral concepts in general. But I haven't stuck to one set of topics. In a way, my philosophical career has consisted in dabbling in this and that. When I have had an idea that struck me as promising, I have pursued it. And so I'll elaborate on a range of things I have worked on in philosophy. Michigan PhDs Billy Dunaway and David Plunkett have assembled and edited a sort of head shift on some of my work, and my replies to criticisms there will tell you a lot more than I can say here. I should start out the rest of what I say today by mentioning a couple of blunders on my part that I now recognize. In my final 2012 book, Meaning and Normativity, I treat meaning as a normative concept, but I don't say how what something means to have causal effects. Cornell realists, as we call them, challenge views like mine by arguing that moral properties have causal effects. And it's clearly right that they do, but an expressivist like me can explain this. When I say, for instance, that the badness of the Tsarist regime caused its downfall, what I'm saying can amount to a long disjunction. The regime was bad in that it inflicted unnecessary suffering, and it's inflicting unnecessary suffering caused its downfall. Or the regime was bad in that it was lax and permissive, and its laxity caused its downfall, and so forth. Simon Blackburn gives the same explanation. On the same kind of pattern, the concept of meaning could be normative, and even so, what a person's words mean can have causal consequences. A second blunder of mine has been involved in my rejection of Scanlon's account of morality. Scanlon tells us that moral claims have the same kind of status as mathematical claims. For a long time, I rejected this on the grounds that it is inconsistent to deny mathematical truth, whereas true normative claims can be denied without inconsistency. In that they are truths, to deny them is mistaken, but the mistake isn't one of inconsistency. But to claim this, as a contrast, was to forget Gödel's most famous theorem. Gödel showed that any axiom system, if it yields only truths, will miss some mathematical truths. I'm still suspicious of explaining truth as like mathematical truth. Mathematical quandaries and ethical quandaries have a different nature, I'm convinced, and we need a better understanding of the difference. When there are alternative consistent mathematical systems, say, for instance, satisfying the axiom of choice and violating it, what should the choice between them be based on? Roughly, in ethics, the question is what to be for and against. What is the corresponding question for mathematics? I look to the rest of you for help. This leaves me disagreeing with Scanlon on fundamental matters of normative ethics. scandalized out of you that numbers don't count, that the numbers of people benefit are harmed by policy don't bear on its moral justification. I must say, I find such a view ethically bizarre. To me, it seems obvious that the number of people benefited or harmed by a public policy, say, matters immensely, matters ethically. I'm not saying that there can't be reasons for absolute prohibitions that don't depend on numbers. Rather, I think my view on such matters is close to Brandt's utilitarianism, and there could be benefit in the public recognition of rules that prohibit certain kinds of acts, regardless of how many people will be advantaged or disadvantaged. But that's going to be because of the benefits of treating a requirement or a prohibition as absolute. I don't know whether further inquiry would bring us closer to agreement that fundamentally numbers count. If it wouldn't, that brings me back to the sorts of meta-ethical questions that have been the main focus of my career, to questions of moral epistemology. Return then to the range of things I have explored philosophically during my career. As I have been indicating, we might call out what I've done dabbling. I have dabbled in a fairly wide range of philosophical areas, some tied closely to ethics and some not. One thing I worked on in graduate school was debate between Carnap and Quine. I thought that the main line of Carnap's could resist Quine's attacks. When I took Quine's graduate course, Word on Object, he gave me a grade A on my first short paper, a paper I thought fairly trivial. I was much more excited by my second paper, but Quine gave it a B+, a low grade for a graduate student. He found me confused on my very first page. I spent the whole summer reworking the paper and gave the revision to Quine. To my astonishment, he had read it right away, and he called me into his office. "Now I see what you're doing," he said. "It's all in Philistal's thesis." So Dr. Philistal had gotten his PhD with Quine at Harvard, and so his dissertation was in the Harvard Library and where I could read it. I concluded that Quine was right about Philistal. Sometime later, though, I thought I could get further on the issues and revised my paper into a substantial paper that Steve Darwell mentioned, Contingent Identity. I remember long conversations with Kit Fine by the swimming pool at a conference in Key Biscayne. Fine published on these issues a number of years later and took a position against there being any such thing as contingent identity. As Steve Darwell mentioned, I had scrutinized the relation between a clay statue and the piece of clay that comprises it and took it that the two are identical. Fine and the bulk of philosophers who weigh in on the matter consider that they are distinct things, even when they coincide in space and time. The identity of the thing on this view is not just a matter of its extent in space and time, but of what its extent would have been in counterfactual circumstances. All this raises questions I'm not sure I can answer. What's at stake in questions of which pairs of things are identical, whether to say the clay statue is identical to the piece of clay that comprises it? Another line of my work, this one with Bill Harper, developed a proposal by Robert Stalnaker. Bill and I are embarrassed that we buried the credit too deep in the footnotes so that many readers thought the idea originated with us. At a symposium that Harper reported on the second time I encountered him, David Lewis proved that what at first seemed a puzzling result, that no non-trivial if-then propositional connective has the following feature. The probability of the conditional that forms is always the corresponding conditional probability. My impression is that Lewis didn't understand why this can't happen, even though he found a proof that it can't. Selmecker, though, Harper reported, managed to say what could be going on. Suppose the correlation between smoking and cancer weren't because smoking tends to cause cancer, but because some common factor tends to cause both. Knowing this, my degree of credence for if I'm going to smoke, then I'm going to get cancer should be higher than my degree of credence for if I'm going to refrain from smoking, then I'm going to get cancer. But my credence in if I were to smoke, I would get cancer should be just as high as my degree of credence in if I were to abstain, I would get cancer. The nature of one thing causing another, as opposed to the two being correlated through a common cause, is clearly important. Indeed, it is as important as any epistemological matter, I would think. What to do depends heavily on it. The distinction is central to living in light of our evidence. All this led me to study two proposed foundations for conditionals, the Stolnacher-Thomason propositional connective and the system proposed by the vastly underappreciated Ernest Adams. In a 1981 paper, Two Recent Theories of Conditionals, I argued that the propositional connective account works for subjective conditionals, like if I were to smoke, then I would get cancer, and the view that conditionals express degrees of conditional credence works for indicative conditionals, like if I'm going to smoke, then I'm going to get cancer. The two systems have almost the same logic, except that indicative conditionals sometimes don't make sense in contexts where subjective conditionals do. But the conditionals of the two logics is just that, I argued, a coincidence. It isn't because the two kinds of conditionals have a similar basis or underlying construction or underlying structure. The subjective conditional is a propositional function, whereas the indicative conditional isn't. I didn't publish much on this, but after I studied exploring these matters without publishing, the eminent statistician Judea Pearl worked things out. My impression from talking with statisticians is that the field has not taken in Pearl's work. It's recognized as a truism that correlation is not causation. And when I was a boy, my mother got a master's degree in industrial relations so that she could get jobs now that the kids, we kids were growing up. As a path to employment, her quest was an utter failure because nepotism rules disqualified her as working too close in areas my dad worked in. But this was a wonderful way for a 10-year-old like me to learn some statistics, calculating correlations and getting it firmly in mind that correlation is not causation. But although statisticians know that correlation isn't causation, and spend a lot of time and a lot of effort to distinguish non-causal like correlations from causal correlations correctly, they standardly ignore questions of what the basis of the distinction is. I know this because while I was working on this, the statistics library of my late father-in-law stood on a bookcase in my office. So I had easy access to what statisticians had to say on these matters. Almost nothing, the answer was. Later, I read Judea Pearl's explanation of why this was. The great statistician Fisher opposed the whole idea of causation. Like Bertrand Russell, he thought it was a pseudo-concept. and the whole field followed him in this. Surely this is perverse, and I have taken a strong unpublished interest on how we can reason to well-founded causal conclusions. In brief, we reason from truisms, like that the landing of coin doesn't directly cause or prevent cancer. This is a subject on which my colleague Jim Joyce has done important work, and I keep wondering if I should return to working on it, whether I can supplement what Pearl and Joyce have done. Another piece of dabbling I engaged on, this one published, concerns the value of truth. Why aim to accord high degrees of belief to truths and low to falsehoods? Perhaps believing truth has value in itself, as does not believing falsehoods. But a systematic feature of true beliefs is how they can guide us through life in pursuit of things that matter. Significant truths have guidance value, as I call it. I tried to explain this notion of guidance value in the sense in which high credence truths systematically have it. This needs a fair amount of explanation and elaboration, which I won't repeat here. But whatever kind of value true beliefs might have, and whatever other kinds of disvalue false beliefs might have, guidance value is a crucial kind of value that true beliefs have. A substantial part of what I have tried to elucidate in my career is meanings, in particular the meanings of normative terms. But I pursued this project for a long time without trying to explain the concept of meaning. I voted to have a well-founded view on this, but for the longest time I couldn't get anywhere on it. I then looked at something that's a little cryptic, said, which I found vastly promising. I thought he hadn't gotten some aspects right of the kind of view he was advocating, but what he said led in fruitful directions. And so later in my philosophical career, my last big philosophical project was to try to fix up and develop Kripke's account. Kripke, as I read him, treats meaning as a normative concept of a special kind. Wittgenstein claims that meaning is used. To say what a term means is to say something about what's systematic and how it is used. On the view I took loosely from Kripke, meaning is not how it is used, but how to use it. Or more precisely, it's a central aspect of how to use it. Now, how it is used, in fact, will be the basis for how to use it. The reason to use it in that way, but saying what it means isn't saying how it is used. It is saying, on account of how it is used, how to use it. So later in my career, I undertook to fill this vast gap in my views. I rejected a view of Paul Horich that I found inadequate. Horich takes what a term means as a causal explanatory concept, like in this regard the concept of valence in chemistry. As he refined and expanded his explication, I found that my chief objection to it no longer stuck. In the forthcoming test script on various aspects of my work, my long-term replies to critics, among other things, concedes a lot to Horich. It could be that we have more than one concept of meaning, Horich's causal explanatory one, and my own Kripke emulating normative one. I did include in my Festschrift reply to an argument that when his and my accounts come apart from each other, The normative one is the one that fits what we mean by meaning. Even if I'm right on this, however, it seems a somewhat paltry claim to make, not something that belongs in the center of a long book. One of my regrets, then, is that I've devoted so much effort to the meaning of meaning. Even if I ended up being right, it may well be that other pursuits would have had higher philosophical payoffs. High philosophical payoffs is what I always strive for. My charge in the Dewey Lectures was, among other things, to draw lessons from my career. I find it very difficult to figure out how to do this. I do, though, want to end with a diatribe in favor of clear writing. I expect that my own writing isn't always ideally clear, but clarity is something I always strive for. I'm perturbed that sometimes students are pressured to replace clear writing with writing that is more obscure. We need to stress obscurity is not profundity. Some profundities, to be sure, are difficult in themselves and couldn't be made to read swimmingly. Proving Gödel's incompleteness theorem might be a prime example. But if some profundities are bound to come across obscurely, it doesn't follow that obscurity makes for profundity. A writer who manages to convey a thought clearly shouldn't be pressed toward obscurity. I remember that once a brilliant friend gave me something of hers to read, and I immediately saw ways to make it read more clearly and forcefully. She didn't like my rewriting. It didn't make what she was saying look difficult enough. I continued to think that I was right and she was wrong. My senior year as an undergraduate, I was taking Richard Brandt's moral philosophy seminar, and I was assigned to write my short paper that week on act utilitarianism versus rule utilitarianism. Brandt always gave us a remarkable list of readings on a topic. That week, as he handed out the reading list, he added, "And I have a little piece that I have placed on reserve at the library." Well, I forgot all about his little piece and wrote my paper arguing that there is a version of rule utilitarianism that is distinct from act utilitarianism. Brandt asked in a hurt tone of voice, "Did you read my little piece?" And I was filled with embarrassment. The next week, I wrote an extra seminar paper. By then I knew what I thought and wrote it up. Brandt said, "If this is true, it ought to be publishable." Those were exciting words for an undergraduate to hear, but he added, "It's not publishable yet." So I went off and tried to rewrite it, getting the same response. The following year, my paper had been rejected more than once, and I was in Ghana. Brandt sent me a long letter, along with a seminar paper by a young genius named John Troyer, whom I didn't know yet. Both Brandt's letter and Troyer's paper struck me as hopelessly mixed up. Since days were hot in that tropical clime, our school day ended at 1:30, and I had time after a nap to do some of my own work. My little sister, Sarah, is 3 years younger than me and incredibly smart. Growing up, we had long conversations with me explaining things to her. In Ghana, I thought to myself, the only way I'm going to get this to work is to pretend to myself that I am explaining to Sarah when she was 12 years old. I worked in this spirit very slowly and sent it off again to Brandt this time and to the American Philosophical Quarterly. Brandt wrote, "Now it's publishable." The APQ answered they didn't publish discussion notes, but their reader much liked my piece, so they had forwarded it to the Australian Journal of Philosophy. And so that became my first published article. I never again worked long and hard enough to achieve the same degree of clarity, but I knew what standard I should have been aiming for. So my philosophical career, in short, has been of considerable variety. And in this lecture, I've commented on some aspects that I find significant. I comment on those and other aspects in my replies to the Festschrift. Jerome Schaefer at Swarthmore introduced me to fascinating lines of thinking, and I hope that with the help of the rest of you, I've gotten somewhere on some of them. To me, the philosophical thinking of you and others have been of a value that's immense. Thank you.